Professor McAleese, Professor Eamon Duffy, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends and colleagues, I would like to welcome you all to the von Hügel Institute annual lecture, which will be delivered by Professor McAleese. The title of Professor McAleese's lecture is Governing the Church, the Imperative of Collegiality. And this lecture is the highlight of this year's von Hügel Institute lecture series, which explored the theme of faith and governance in response to Pope Benedict's declaration of 2013 as a year of faith. So we were interested in this angle. And lectures in this series have covered the relationship between faith communities and national governance, international governance, global financial governance, and human rights. But of course, the Catholic Church, with a population, a membership of well over a billion, found in every human society and culture, is both a key actor in all of these levels of governance, as well as a system of governance in its own right. And the Church, in its long history, has borrowed from models of governance in which it found itself, but also influenced these systems, so there's a kind of dialectical relationship between the Church's life and the life of the society in which it found itself. And sometimes it's presented as a monolithic organization, whereas in fact it is characterized by a great diversity. And there always have been competing positions within the Church as to how it should govern itself. And we can think here of the long conflict from the Middle Ages between the conciliarists and the Caesaro-papalists, as they were called, so two kind of models of the Church. And I think what's extraordinary is that we are still debating these issues some 800 years, so about the time Cambridge University was founded, after Marsilius of Padua formulated his conciliarist theses. And I think Professor Mary McAleese is extremely well placed to discuss these questions in tonight's lecture, which I think we can see as in continuity with this long debate that's been going on inside the Church, and I think will continue as well. She was twice elected President of Ireland, a position she held from 1997 to 2011, and previously she was Professor of Criminal Law, Criminology and Penology at Trinity College Dublin. In 1987, became Director of the Institute of Professional Legal Studies at her alma mater, which is Queen's University Belfast. In 1994, she became the first female pro-vice chancellor of Queen's University in Belfast. On retiring as president, she undertook doctoral studies, and she's still undergoing, at the Jesuit Gregorian University in Rome on the topic of collegiality in the Church, and published a book on this topic 2 years ago. So I think we could say Professor McAleese can bring her experience of governance at the highest levels in Ireland to bear on this question of governance within the Church, which she will address tonight. We're also very fortunate in having Professor Eamon Duffy of Magdalen College, Cambridge, to respond to Professor McAleese's lecture. And after that, there'll be some time for questions and answers. And as you know, Professor Duffy is one of our foremost church historians, and has been instrumental in changing our understanding of the Reformation, particularly from a Catholic perspective. He's also published books and many works on the papacy, individual popes, etc. And I think he's about to publish a book on prayer, is that right? Which I think is something we badly need today as well, as you might gather after this lecture. So without further ado, I give the floor to Professor McAleese.
Good evening, everyone, and my thanks to each one of you for being here on a very cold and wet night. Thank you also to the von Hügel Institute and indeed to Sean for inviting me to give this lecture. The subject is church governance. I'm kind of tickled by the idea of the parallel between my former life as the second woman in a row as President of Ireland and the paralleling of that with church governance. I think there's some way to go before Eamon will be writing that history. But we can wish. Maybe we should pray. Anyway, the subject is church governance. The church in question is the Latin Rite Catholic Church, sometimes called the Roman Catholic Church, of which I am a member. The subtitle of the talk is The Imperative of Collegiality. The word imperative is designed to strike a note of urgency and necessity. The word collegiality is shorthand for the modernization of church governance, but in particular, the development of, or more accurately, according to some historians, the restoration of shared collegial governance between the Pope and the bishops of the universal church. It's an issue that was hotly debated in the 1960s at the Second Vatican Council. I think it's probably safe to say that no subject provoked such angry debate. But nothing changed in practice after the council in terms of governance. When Francis became Pope a year ago, church governance was essentially the same unreformed, creaking, feudal monarchy it had been for generations before the council, prompting Nicholas Lash of this parish to ask if the shutters were not coming down on the Second Vatican Council, and lamenting that the church's quasi-civil service, which is called the Curia, as you know, had actually intensified its central control, and in doing that, had, in his words, frustrated the episcopacy in the recovery of a proper sense of episcopal authority and the development of appropriate structures of collegial governance. And that word recovery is important here because it is a reminder that the early church had been synodal and collegial in its governance rather than what we became accustomed to as exclusive primatialism, one man rule. There are some very encouraging signs from Pope Francis that significant changes to church governance, and I'm talking here in terms of governance of the universal church, but also at diocesan and at national and regional level, that these things are on his radar. And importantly, that in relation to universal church governance, they are directed towards two ends, creating collegial governance and towards Christian unity. He has flagged both these issues, and they are both of extraordinary significance. 50 years ago, as you know, Pope John the 23rd set out to radically update the church when he convened the Second Vatican Council. He famously said that he wanted a church that was a garden, not a museum. And with his dying breath, almost a year after the council opened, he pleaded for Christian unity in the words, ut omnes unum sint. Things did not, of course, turn out as the council had hoped, and as many had hoped. And Francis himself, Pope Francis, has lamented that there has been, in his words, more about law than about grace, more about the church than about Christ, more about the Pope than about God's word. The council, subject to the Pope's approval, of course, the Vatican Council, had power to change doctrine, to legislate for the universal church. And in a welter, those of you who are familiar with the documents will know that, I don't know, did anybody ever count the actual number of words that came out? But it must have run to millions of words. A welter of declarations and decrees and constitutions, the old elitist imperial church was swept away, at least on paper, particularly in the dogmatic constitution on the church, known as Lumen Gentium. And it left papal primacy intact, but Lumen Gentium provided for the first time for future collegial governance of the church by the College of Bishops with the Pope as its head. Now that was a critical issue, it remains a critical issue for church unity, as well as for more open and accountable governance. There was to be greater decentralisation, not everything centred in Rome, but pushed out to the regions. Greater subsidiarity, more power for local bishops and local episcopal conferences. As well, of course, importantly, as new structures for sustained real engagement with the laity at parish and diocesan level. the old fixed pyramid with the pay, pray and obey laity right down at the bottom and all was talked down to from the top, that was to be replaced with a vision of the equality of dignity of every single member of the people of God, clergy and laity alike, and each was to have a share according to their own. They were to have a share in the church's tasks of preaching, of teaching, and of governing. It's very interesting. The word governance always arises when we're talking to clergy, but somehow, as soon as you start to talk about lay people involved in preaching, teaching, and governance, the word suddenly becomes service. It's always very interesting to me how these words get fuzzy around the edges. But these new structures were supposed to ensure a much greater level of two-way communication between all levels in the church. And I think it's true to say that we did, at least for a while, those of us who are of a certain age, we did for a while experience that surging energy of renewal and of change, particularly with regard to the liturgy and particularly with the new focus on ecumenism. It took almost 20 years to translate the council's decisions into law, into what became the 1983, the new code of canon law. That was a pity, and it was a big mistake, because by then, the gravitational pull of powerful, centralised conservatism had already stalled the conciliar momentum, because, frankly, no structure had been left in place to carry forward that momentum. Be different in the religious orders. The religious orders did have structures, and I think there's a lot of work to be done to tell us just to what extent they became, if you like, the crucibles of care for the council. But in general, there were no universal church structures given the task of carrying the council. And so, while the faithful and the world moved on, the curial church remained even further behind the curve. The great church scholar Ladislas Orsi, still remarkably alive now and is well into his 90s, he remarked several years ago that we have to see the council not as an immediate revolution, but rather, in his words, as a slow burn, involving a very long and complex process of reception that can take centuries rather than decades. But somewhat prophetically, it seems to me, at a conference in Rome in January of 2013, he pointed out that having looked at all the councils, he was convinced that the 50-year mark, the passage of 50 years, had proved to be a turning point at all other councils. And he was of the view that the same might be true for this council. And we are now at that 50-year point, as you know. The council opened in 1962, closed in 65. And unexpectedly, we have a pope whose talk is all of fulfilling the council. I think rather disarmingly, Francis admitted some months into office, and he's a very frank talker, as we've now got to know, but he admitted that he learnt the hard way that his own once very authoritarian way of making decisions created a lot of problems. He added, I think one of the most beautiful things that he said from my point of view, he added, eventually people get tired of authoritarianism. And for me, that's a perfect and a very succinct summation of the feeling of many contemporary pro-conciliar Catholics who had been living in what James Carroll has described as internal exile, in a church where communio was being hollowed out by what Francis has called an excessive centralization, which rather than proving helpful, actually complicates the church's life and her missionary outreach. But an anti-authoritarian pope is in itself no guarantee that the church will change. And Francis has said emphatically he wants change. Many will already be aware of his stated intention to reform the Curia, his appointment of that group of eight cardinals, headed by Cardinal Maradiaga of Honduras, to advise him on curial reform. And no group is closer to the Pope than this kitchen cabinet is right this moment. But his plans for change are considerably more extensive. They really are root and branch. And the first thing that he has prioritised, as many of us will have observed, is attitudinal change. Tone. Not doctrine, but tone. Temper. Balance. Focus. Focusing on love. Focusing on the poor. Focusing on the joy of the gospel, the inclusiveness, the healing. The church as, not as he said the other day, a royal court, as he reminded the cardinals, but he described it as a field hospital where people come to have their wounds bound. And so he prioritises the attitudinal change, which is highly significant in itself, but then just as important and possibly from the long term even more important, he has talked of the systemic structural changes that he believes are needed to ensure that the church continues in a trajectory which takes it away from being a bureaucracy to opening up its pastoral self to the world. In his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, of last November, he set out a very, very broad programme for changes at all the levels in the church. Consultation, he says, is to involve the entire people of God. He's talking about consultation with himself. Consulting not just the bishops, he says, but the entire people of God. Parish and diocesan structures are to become more participative, more inclusive. They're not just to be for those who are a little comfortable, a comfortable clique. There is to be, he describes, sound decentralisation and greater subsidiarity at diocesan level, episcopal conference level, and he has talked about creating a much more elaborated judicial structure, juridic status for the episcopal conferences in order, as he says, to underpin their genuine doctrinal authority, but very importantly, to contribute, as he says, to the concrete realisation of the collegial spirit. Now, anybody who knows the council will recognise this language. It doesn't take a genius to recognise the source of Francis's proposals. The language, the content, these are very familiar. So familiar that I hope you won't mind if I borrow Seamus Mallon's familiar phrase and use it in a different context. For me, Evangelii Gaudium can truly be called Lumen Gentium for slow learners. So the Pope has set this new agenda, clear reform, not quite a new agenda, a recycled agenda, designed to loosen the tight knots and to let the gospel joy flow. But most ecclesiastically literate eyes are focused on the really big question here. And that big question is, will he continue to govern primatially, entirely primatially, as the sole decision maker and legislator for the church? Or will he, as was the will of the majority at Vatican II, and as Christian unity requires, will he share decision making with the bishops? And if so, how will he do that? Crucially, Francis has said that the structural governance changes, as I said, will have to move in a collegial and an ecumenical direction. So he's sending out very strong signals. Cardinal Schönborn lately, just in fact in the last 2 weeks, gave a really very interesting insight into the unhealthy silencing effects of primatial rule. He said at a press conference that he regretted that the Austrian bishops had, in his words, not dared to speak out openly on necessary church reforms. We were, he said, far too hesitant. We certainly lacked courage to speak openly. So the nub of the matter today is whether Pope Francis intends to move to a system in which the bishops are encouraged not to be yes men, but leaders, confident, articulate leaders who can speak freely, who are not merely consulted, but who themselves consult widely at their own local level and then make decisions collegially for the Universal Church with the Pope. A very close look at how Francis has approached this issue, I think, repays the effort. Last June, on June 29th, at an audience for new archbishops, Francis spoke about the path of collegiality. And he said it was the road that can lead the church to grow in harmony with the service of primacy. But then he asked the big question, the question that no one has been able to answer since Vatican II. How can we reconcile in harmony Petrine primacy and collegiality? Which roads are feasible from an ecumenical perspective? So let's look for a moment at just how he might answer those questions that have been hanging in the air since Vatican II. At the moment, he makes all the decisions. He's the boss. He makes all the doctrinal and legislative decisions with occasional advice, essentially from two bodies. One is the very highly influential College of Cardinals. All members are papal appointees, best known, of course, for their role in electing the Pope. And the other body is the Synod of Bishops, which is an occasional gathering of bishop delegates from episcopal conferences around the world, tasked with advising the Pope on a particular subject that he has drawn to their attention normally. Francis has described both as important places for real and active consultation, but currently he believes they are, in his words, much too rigid in form, and he says that he wants real, not ceremonial, consultation. I mean, I'm told by those who have attended synods of bishops and consistories that they bring boredom to a kind of a new art form. So we can expect much more lively debates in both fora, and indeed one of his first acts, as we know, was to appoint this group from the College of Cardinals to advise him. But that's all they will do. He will consult them, they will advise. And better consultation is not shared decision making. And it would, no matter how good those fora are, no matter how lively they are, no matter how good the process of consultation, they would make no impact whatsoever on the governance obstacles to Christian unity, nor would they deliver conciliar, collegial, episcopal governance. So the real test of Francis's attitude to collegial, episcopal governance of the Universal Church involves essentially only two bodies. And they are not, and don't include, the College of Cardinals. They are the Synod of Bishops and the much more important and considerably bigger College of Bishops. The Council acknowledged that the Pope governs with supreme and full primatial authority by divine rule. But it also taught, for the first time, that the College of Bishops, that is the huge number of bishops all around the world, that College of Bishops, with the Pope as its head, also has supreme and full authority over the Universal Church by divine authority in a direct line of apostolic succession. But they cannot exercise that power without the consent of the Pope. So there's a big difference here. The Pope, once he's elected, the button is pushed, he can rule. The College of Bishops need him to push the button before they can engage in governance. The Council, now of course, with its rules set in canon law, it sets out three ways in which the College of Bishops can exercise that extensive power of governance. The first is in an ecumenical council. Only the Pope can call a council, and of course all decisions require his approval. There have been four councils in the past 500 years, and 21, give or take an argument about one or two, 21 in the past 1700 years, so don't get too anxious anytime soon. They are very cumbersome affairs. Traditionally, as we know, they've involved the convocation of all the bishops from around the world. That was easier back in the First Vatican Council, back in 1870, when the number was quite small. Got a little bit more difficult when it ran to a couple of thousand in the Second Vatican Council. The number of bishops is now over twice what it was in the 1960s. We now have over 5,000 bishops. That makes physical convocation very, very difficult. Though I suppose arguably modern communication technologies might make other forms of virtual convocation feasible. The second way is through what is said in the law to be the united action of the bishops dispersed throughout the world, provided that the Pope has publicly declared or freely accepted such an exercise of power. Canon lawyers are really not terribly clear what that meant, but in fairness, it also could conduce to what you might call a global episcopal consensus gained without convocation, but possibly by post, by phone, by email. That's what it could conduce to. But it is the third way, in my view, that gives Pope Francis the best scope to develop collegial episcopal governance, because under the law, he has the power to decide the ways in which the College of Bishops may act collegially with regard to the universal church according to the needs of the church. That is the third way. He decides how they will act. And this papal power has never, ever been used, but of course it could be. The Pope could, for example, create a completely new process or a completely new structure through which the College of Bishops could co-govern with him, something that we've never heard of before. Or, more likely, he could designate an existing structure for that purpose. And the obvious candidate for that would be the current Synod of Bishops, though it would take some revision of that body. The Synod of Bishops is a much smaller body. It's a body of delegates, runs to hundreds, not thousands. And of course, the Synod of Bishops, the delegates come from the episcopal conferences around the world. But the relationship between the Synod of Bishops, the smaller body, and the College of Bishops, the big body, is one of the great canonical mysteries of our time. And things are not as easy as they might appear. First of all, canonical commentators disagree about whether the College of Bishops can lawfully delegate its powers to a smaller body. So that's a fairly significant constitutional issue. Secondly, the Synod of Bishops was created by Pope Paul VI during the Second Vatican Council. It was not created by the Council. In fact, it was a really major shock during the Council to have the Synod created. It is suspected, many writers have said this, that it was set up during the Council to prevent the bishops at the Council from creating a synod that would constitutionally represent them as their college. So what they got, having debated collegiality, having decided they wanted, or having debated at length about the structure they might want, rather than create a structure that was had a direct line of authority from the College of Bishops, the Pope arrived in one morning and informed them that he had now created a Synod of Bishops. But what was it? It was his body. It was a body that advised him in his primatial role. And its link with the College of Bishops, of course, there was no constitutional link with the College of Bishops. And indeed, when it came to writing up and drafting the 1983 Code of Canon Law, those who drafted the code went to a lot of bother to make sure that there was no reference to the synod that could ever be interpreted as it being representative of the College of Bishops, precisely because of these unresolved constitutional issues. The argument goes that if the Synod of Bishops could legally represent the College of Bishops, you know, as a scaled-down version with its powers, then it would effectively, every time it met, it would effectively be a mini ecumenical council with full powers of governance over the church. That scenario was emphatically rejected by one Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. The Synod has never ever operated as anything other than an advisory body to the Pope in the exercise of his primatial power. It has never ever been involved in church governance, and that has major ramifications for church unity. Synodality and collegiality in other Christian traditions, notably the Anglican and the Orthodox traditions, are not simply about giving advice to a primate or being consulted from the top, but they are about decision-making. And the difference is crucial. Archbishop John Quinn put it forcefully way back in 1996 when he wrote, he said, large segments of the Catholic Church, as well as many Orthodox and other Christians, do not believe that collegiality and subsidiarity are being practiced in the Catholic Church in a sufficiently meaningful way. The seriousness of our obligation to seek Christian unity, means that this obstacle to unity cannot be overlooked or dismissed as if it were the quirk of malcontents or the scheme of those who want to undermine the papacy. In 1998, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, while acknowledging that they had arrived at convergence on the need for a universal primacy exercised by the Bishop of Rome as a sign and safeguard of unity within a reunited church, which it seems to me is an extraordinary and wonderful and magnificent statement, they pointedly asserted the need for the universal primate to exercise his ministry in collegial association with other bishops. The current Synod of Bishops does not meet that test of collegial association. It is not collegial episcopal governance. But there are two possible ways open to Pope Francis of transforming the Synod into a decision-making body. One, of course, involves taking the papal bull by the horns and making the Synod legally representative of the College of Bishops. That's the more difficult route constitutionally, but that's one, and that certainly would be quite extraordinary. The second doesn't involve doing that. So let's just take the second one first, because it's the easier path. Under canon law, the Pope has power to give the Synod of Bishops, as it currently is, a body of primatial origin, essentially an advisory body that has only ever operated as an advisory body, but he has a residual power to give it the right to make decisions. He can ask it to make decisions. Of course, they're subject to his overall power of veto, his overall agreement. Now, no pope has ever done so, and Pope Benedict is on the record as being strongly against doing so, even though the law provides for it. Yet this is by far the most straightforward way of creating at least an embryonic form of collegial episcopal decision-making in the Catholic Church. The decision-making powers would be powers delegated to the Synod by the Pope, not by the College of Bishops. Whether that would meet the test of collegiality necessary for Christian unity, well, there are people in this audience better qualified than I am to answer that. But that's not certain. But certainly it could legitimately be seen as a reconciliation of sorts between primatialism and collegial episcopal governance. I believe it could even be road tested quite soon. The Pope has called both an extraordinary and an ordinary Synod of Bishops to talk about aspects of the family. The extraordinary Synod, which deals with urgent matters, it's going to meet this October to discuss what is called the challenges facing the family in the context of evangelization. Now, its role is to urgently advise the Pope on the state of the question and to bring forward proposals. Then a year later, there is to be an ordinary synod. back in 2015 that will identify and suggest to the Pope what are called new working guidelines for the pastoral care of the human person and the family, and presumably to do that in the light of the extraordinary synod. Normally, such synods advise the Pope and he makes the decisions. But it would be, in my view, politically masterful for Francis to make one or other bodies, or both of these synods, decision-making bodies, with him, of course, as its head, all decisions subject to his approval. He has the power to do so, and the contextual impetus is also very powerful. Because the preparations for the Extraordinary Synod, and some of you may have been involved in these preparations, they have involved actively canvassing grassroots opinions on a remarkable range of controversial subjects, from artificial contraception to access to the sacraments for divorced and remarried Catholics, from cohabitation to gay marriage, much, much more. And when the results are analysed, and indeed some of the analysis is already available to us from those Episcopal conferences which have decided to publish, when the results are analysed, the bishops are likely to, and the Pope, are likely to face overwhelming evidence of a very strong disconnect, certainly at least in the Western world, between the faithful's opinions and church teaching and church practice in a significant number of areas. Now, if doctrinal or procedural changes are coming down the line as a result of that, how much more impactful would they be if they came from a collegial decision of the Pope and the Synod of Bishops? Because given the range and the extent of grassroots input filtered through the Episcopal conferences, and that in turn going to the Synod of Bishops, these decisions could then truly be said to have evolved from a process that involved each tier of the people of God. It would be a collegial governance first for the church. Now, that is one way to create a closely, primatially controlled form of collegial episcopal governance, cum petro et sub petro. The synod in such a scenario would not be a standing decision-making body, but at the Pope's discretion could toggle between both, at times advisory, at times decision-making. The other way, and by far, of course, the most exciting, would be the first option, for the Pope to use the third way permitted by the Council and by canon law, and that is to designate the Synod of Bishops as a standing decision-making body representative of the College of Bishops, whether by partial delegation or by full delegation. For example, it would be perfectly possible to have partial delegation and to go back to the idea of virtual convocation to canvass the bishops' views around the world, to get their majority assent, consent, consensus to any particular proposed decision. There are a number of options. The synod's powers would be those delegated by the College of Bishops, so plugged into the council, and not those delegated by the Pope. The Synod would indeed become, effectively, a mini ecumenical council with supreme and full power of governance, or with partial delegation requiring some form of connectedness to the full College of Bishops. But, you know, post, email, it's all possible these days. This is the more radical option, it's the more difficult option constitutionally. Is probably the least likely one in the short term, but it is the one that would clearly have the least difficulty meeting the test of Christian unity and indeed would create effective episcopal collegial governance. So now we know Francis can. He has the power to transform the synod into a collegial decision-making body, but of course the big question is, will he? We've had an avalanche of words, an avalanche of ideas. We've had great promises. We know he plans to change the synod in some way. He has said himself, in his words, it's time to change the methods of the Synod of Bishops because it seems to me, he says, the current method is not dynamic. And then he says, intriguingly, this will have an ecumenical value, especially with our Orthodox brethren. From them, we can learn more about the meaning of episcopal collegiality and the tradition of synodality. In ecumenical relations, he says, it is important not only to know each other better, but to recognize what the Spirit has sown in the other as a gift for us. In Evangelii Gaudium, he opened the debate even further. He says, since I am called to put into practice what I ask of others, I too must think about a conversion of the papacy. It's my duty as the Bishop of Rome to be open to suggestions which can make the exercise of my ministry more faithful to the meaning which Jesus Christ wished to give it and to the present needs of evangelization. Pope John Paul, he says, asked for help in finding a way of exercising the primacy, which, while in no way renouncing what is essential to its mission, is nonetheless open to a new situation. And then, with his great frankness, Pope Francis says, we've made little progress in this regard. The papacy and the central structures of the universal church also need to hear the call to pastoral conversion. Last November, at the press conference announcing the extraordinary synod, the General Secretary to the synod stated that with regard to the methodological renewal, the idea is that of transforming the synodal institution into a real and effective tool of communication through which the collegiality hoped for at the Vatican Council is expressed and achieved. He spoke of changes to structure, to methodology, which would allow the Synod to adequately perform its mission of promoting episcopal collegiality, cum petro et sub petro, in the governance of the universal church. These words are not there lightly. Every one of them is placed quite deliberately. These strong hints of change to the Synod in the context of advancing both collegiality and church unity, they make absolutely no sense whatsoever unless they involve synodal decision making. If they mean anything less than that, then all they mean is what we already have, advisory bodies, the status quo. So no matter what language it may be dressed up in, if the movement is not towards synodal decision-making, then these are just more words. And quite frankly, for 50 years, that word collegiality has been stretched and elasticated so many ways that it almost lost the meaning that the Council wished it to have. Francis, it seems to me, wishes it to have the conciliar meaning. He's warned, of course, that he will not move hastily. He needs time for what he describes as wise discernment, because he says we always need time to lay the foundations for real and effective change. And yet he's also spoken of the urgent need for a new balance in the church. Otherwise, as he has said, the moral edifice of the church is likely to fall like a house of cards. Until now, the centre, and it's a centre that he's trying to bring with him, to convert, to move, to shift. Until now, the centre has believed it could only hold through primatialism and unquestioning obedience to the exclusively top-down teaching magisterium. And that tight grip approach has had very, very damaging consequences for the church in the modern world, all of them self-inflicted. The current grassroots response to the questionnaire from the extraordinary Synod of Bishops, it could be a template for the kind of noisy, messy, argumentative church the Vatican Council envisaged, and indeed was itself. It was pretty noisy, messy, and argumentative. And Francis seems perfectly comfortable with noisy, messy, and argumentative. It's And it seems to me that what he wants is not this top-down, control-driven passivity, that this control system that relies essentially on silent passivity, but a healthy, vibrant communio of the diverse, not of clones, but of the diverse, engaged in active listening, active talking, top down, bottom up, sideways, unafraid of bad news. Think back to Cardinal Schönborn. The bishops did not want to be bringing bad news to the Pope. So they were cowards. They lacked courage. But a church unafraid of bad news, a church unafraid of healthy debate. And if you can plug that grassroots debate into the Episcopal conferences, as has been done for this synod, and plug the Episcopal conferences into the College of Bishops with the Pope as its head, the potential for a vibrant communio living their lives in rich diversity could be such a real leaven in the maelstrom of life, and very importantly, also a huge driver of Christian unity. A decision-making synod, of course, while historic, would not, however, change the fact that all decisions would continue to be filtered exclusively through the male unmarried clerical episcopacy. And I think the Synod on the Family is a particularly good example, possibly a particularly bad example, of how weak the expertise of a particular forum comprised of male unmarried clerics can be. I mean, I just think for a moment, think of a government. Think of a government that's going to discuss military life, right? And it's going to have an advisory body advising it on military life. And the only people who are drafted in are conscientious objectors. It's the nearest parallel I can think of. Not a bad parallel. So, an advisory body on the family comprised entirely of men who have consciously chosen not to be fathers or spouses or to live a family life. That's what you get when you have the kind of governance structure that we currently have. The absence of laity, and in particular women, from ecclesial decision-making and high-level spheres of influence is, of course, it's a line that simply cannot hold. It's a line that is actually not holding in any event because it's rapidly leeching trust and credibility and people. Francis has openly acknowledged that and, unfortunately, has not yet been able to posit any practical solutions, possibly because, of course, the link between governance and holy orders currently limits his scope for action quite considerably. But he has addressed the issue, probably the most, indeed the most open pope to have done so in my lifetime. It's hard to know if the charismatic and popular Francis has time on his side. His very refreshing approach seems to have slowed the tide of cynicism, managed to create maybe a new tide of wonder and curiosity. But whether he can turn the tide, well, that remains to be seen. Somewhat despairingly, John mentioned that I wrote a book on collegiality 2 years ago, but at least it was written in the language of despair, I think, but I at least dared to hope that somehow something would oxygenate Ladislas Orsi's slow burn and fan it to a flame. And at the end of the book, I quoted Teilhard de Chardin's famous statement, "Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness the energies of love. And then, for the second time in history, we shall have discovered fire." A year later, a man arrived from Argentina with a blowtorch in his suitcase. And now hearts are alight with something infinitely more impatient, more unforgiving than mere hope, a driven thing called expectation. The church has now entered the heady era of the imperative of expectation. Cardinal Maradiaga has said, just in the last few weeks, he said, I strongly believe that the church has reached the dawn of a new era with respect. We have heard that before. And yet, I strongly hope that this time he is right. If not, Hans Küng has repeated his warning that the Catholic Church, in his view, will experience a new ice age instead of a spring and run the risk of dwindling into a barely relevant large sect. Francis understands these risks only too well, for he has warned against a church in which, in very familiar words, he says, a tomb psychology develops and slowly transforms Christians into mummies in a museum. When did we hear the word museum before? John the 23rd. Enter John the 23rd with his gardening tools. For the Catholic Church, Pope Francis is Groundhog Day. Enjoy.